Here's a really special deal on a great product from our friends over at Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. You can now receive a $39 bottle of artisanal fresh pressed oil free if you just pay $1 to help cover shipping. And there's nothing else you must buy now or ever. It's a wonderful opportunity because with olive oil, my number one rule is the fresher, the better. That's because the olive is a fruit, and olive oil is actually a fruit juice. Like any other fruit juice, extra virgin olive oil is at its glorious peak of freshness, flavor, and nutritional potency when fresh squeezed. And that's what's missing with so many supermarket olive oils. After sitting on the shelf for months or even years, they've lost their freshness and can't compare with just pressed EVU shipped direct from the new harvest. Here at Milk Street, we really like these oils' vibrant, grassy flavors, as well as the intoxicating aroma, just like a garden in a bottle. Prove it yourself with no obligation to buy anything ever. For your free $39 bottle direct from an award-winning artisanal farm, go to getfresh177.com. That's getfresh177.com. One last time, getfresh177.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hi, this is Christopher Kimball. Thanks for downloading this week's podcast. You can go to our website, 177milkstreet.com, to stream our television show, get our recipes, or take our free online cooking classes. Enjoy the show. This is Milk Street Radio from PRX. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball.
Okay, so here we are at Jokes on Pet, and...
Jalatsi
is going to show us how to make rice porridge. And this is a great way of using day-old rice. You can use freshly cooked rice too, but the day-old is great because it'll soak up the flavor of the soup as she makes it.
That was Andy Ricker, chef owner of the Pok Pok restaurants and an expert in the cuisine of northern Thailand. I visited Andy at his part-time house outside of Chiang Mai. He introduced me to Thai cooking, to his spirit house, and his cat, Jamuk. But right now, it's time to check in with Reina Javeri and hear what's going on in the kitchen at Milk Street. Hi, Reina. How are you?
I'm well, Chris. Hi.
This week, it's Swiss chard week. and the question is, what do you do with Swiss chard? Well, we were in London a few months ago, ended up cooking with Fuchsia Dunlop, author of Every Grain of Rice. And she has this great method of cooking these greens. It involves aromatics, some Swiss chard, and some hot oil.
So yeah, Chris, we actually love this method that Fuchsia introduced us to. It turns out that it's a classic Cantonese method. We use two bunches of Swiss chard and remove the stems first, and then use a half steam, half sauté method, which is easier and better than blanching. To add that all that flavor, we top this with aromatics such as scallions, ginger, and serrano. And then, this is important, we heat our oil till it's smoking hot.
So is this like the lousy six-month-old canola oil I've sitting in my pantry, or is this something different?
First of all, you need to throw that out. Next, you need to get some grapeseed oil for this recipe. We use 2 tablespoons of grapeseed or vegetable oil, fresh. And in addition to that, we use 1 tablespoon of sesame oil in the same pan that we cook our greens in. And again, you want to make sure that oil is really smoking hot, and then pour this directly over the aromatics in the bowl.
And this is a toasted sesame oil, right?
So yes, this is a toasted sesame oil, and what it's going to do is really draw out all the flavors of those aromatics while still keeping the flavor of the greens fresh.
So to finish, is that it, or do we add anything else?
A couple more things. We're going to add a little bit of soy sauce and some unseasoned rice wine vinegar, and these add some acidity and light sweetness without overwhelming the dish.
So now we have flavor, we have hot oil, we have non-bitter greens. I actually like Swiss chard now.
And it's fast.
And it's fast. Thank you, Raina.
You can get our recipe for sizzling greens on our website, milkstreetradio.com.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. Now let's take some of your cooking questions with my co-host, Sarah Moulton, star of Sarah's Weeknight Meals, also author of Home Cooking 101. Sarah, how are you? You ready to take some calls?
Chris, I sure am. I'm prepared.
One of us has to be prepared.
That's true.
It's Chris and Sarah at Milk Street. How can we help you?
Yes, I have a question about cabbage rolls.
Okay.
I made cabbage rolls for the first time last week, and they came out all right. The only problem I had was getting the leaves to separate from the head. I tried removing them from the raw head, as one recipe suggested. They were very tight and kept tearing. I then tried removing the corn, boiling the whole head.
Uh-huh.
This was easier for the leaves to stay intact, but the head kept bobbing around, and it was like an accident waiting to happen.
I thought you were going to say it looked like, well, I won't say. Yeah.
I think you said you tried it cutting off a bit of the core and then coring the cabbage first. Did that work without cooking it?
The leaves were so tight against the head.
Right. I see.
And I tried 2 different heads, and they kept ripping.
I would say 1 or 2 minutes, just simmer it.
And you can weight it down with, say, a plate or, you know, some sort of lid that you put in there and then put a weight on it so it sort of stays underwater for a couple of minutes.
Or the easiest thing to do would be to steam it.
I didn't think about that.
Oh, steaming.
To just use
an
inch of water at the bottom of the big stock pot and put it on a steaming rack.
That's a good idea.
And that would be the easiest.
And then what you're going to have to do is it's sort of like you're going to have to take a couple of the outer leaves off, and then when they no longer are coming off, you put it back in, give it a, you know, another couple of minutes and keep going.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good idea, the steaming. I didn't think about steaming it at all.
A lot of cultures steam all the time. Even the English steam.
I know, but it's
desserts.
Not on our radar screen the way it should be.
You know, there was a recipe I just found where they took a chicken with a chili paste in a steamer, and underneath was liquid with some lemongrass, other things. But they steamed the chicken, and the juices dripped down into the liquid.
Wow, so you got a twofer.
And you get a soup.
So you get
some chili paste and chicken.
Yummy.
And then you had the steamed chicken. Ah.
Only trouble with steaming is you have to keep replenishing the liquid because it does eventually evaporate. So if it's long term, you know, like I used to steam beets, and bigger ones take 45 minutes. You have to keep putting more water in. But, you know, I think this is a good idea with the cabbage.
Yeah.
But then, be careful when you pull the lid off, because then that steam will hit you. So wear good gloves and all that.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I like that image of the bobbing.
Well, I wasn't going to go there. It's not Halloween. We're just talking about.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care. Thanks so much for calling.
It's Chris and Sarah. How can we help you?
Hi, Chris and Sarah. I had a question for you regarding outfitting a minimalist kitchen. I have been thinking about this because I have friends who are downsizing. I have kids who are heading off to college and beyond. And everybody loves cooking, but we're thinking about simplifying. With that in mind, I just wondered what you might suggest for an ideally streamlined kitchen.
So you're referring to equipment, or you're referring to pantry?
The first part of my question was equipment, but the second part of my question was pantry.
First of all, who are we speaking to?
Carolyn Monty.
Okay.
And I'm calling from Lincoln, Massachusetts.
All right, Carolyn. So a 10-inch knife, chef's knife. And then a serrated knife, a paring knife, and either a large saucepan or a stock pot.
By the way, you can buy the world's cheapest stock pot, but the saucepan, you should spend money.
Right. Then I'd say a 12-inch skillet. That's got to be the workhorse. And then a smaller, like a 10-inch or an 8-inch for omelets or other things like that. Tongs, of course.
Instant meat thermometer.
Cutting board. an assortment of spoons, of course. I love my metal bench scraper because I move everything across the kitchen with it. What else do you think?
I'm high on the Chinese vegetable cleaver or some sort of cleaver. You can use them as a bench scraper as well. The one thing Sarah left off was knife sharpener.
Right.
So pantry, first of all, I think about sauces. Soy sauce, a light soy sauce is also good. Oyster sauce, fish sauce, pomegranate molasses. It's nice to add to soups and stews. Wet paste like tomato paste, anchovy paste, things that come in tubes. There's a few of those.
Canned tomatoes, important.
Canned tomatoes. And then I would also say spices, but spice blends like sitar, you know, from Turkey, which is nice. I would say cumin is essential. Turmeric is essential. And I would try to get one other pepper that's kind of a different kind of pepper would be nice as well, a ground pepper of some kind. And then finally, I would think about the alliums, you know, some shallots and garlic and onion just sort of sitting around.
Sure.
One great way is to mix spices with herbs or mix spices with onions and shallots. You see a lot of cultures mix them up and use them as flavoring. So you can mix and match with those things.
We also have to throw in pasta and dried grains and canned beans, because those are things you can reach for in a pinch and, you know, make a meal. Plus oils and vinegars.
I have a very small kitchen now, relatively speaking, and I like it more. It's easier to cook in. I don't have to walk around the perimeter to find things.
No,
so I'm all for small.
Yeah, no. And then you can find everything. It has to be strategically placed. Anything else we missed that you had on your list?
Well, the question I also had was, as far as the stock pot went, do you think a large Dutch oven could be a substitute for the stock pot?
Most of the time I use a Dutch oven, a 6 to 7 quart Dutch oven, and you can boil pasta in that.
Yeah, these are all good. So thank you very much. I think this would all fit into probably 2 large Rubbermaid bins if you had to be sort of like that nomadic young person who's moving from apartment to apartment and could pack it all up and move it out.
Yep.
So. Yeah, I think so.
Less is more.
That's, yes, exactly. I agree with you.
Yeah. Thank you, Carolyn.
Well, thank you. You have a good one.
Okay, take care.
This is Mill Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. If you'd like your cooking questions answered, give us a call. That number is 1-855-4-BOWTIE, 1-855-4-BOWTIE. You can also email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com.
Hi, it's Sarah and Chris. How can we help you?
Okay, well, while cooking, I notice a lot of recipes call for salt and pepper. And I know what salt brings to a lot of things, but what does pepper do?
Great question. I have the same question. Sarah, we're both listening.
Okay. Well, you know, there's no one kind of pepper, and each one of them brings something to the mix, and black being sort of the most robust. So green is the unripe, and then it gets ripened into black. And then if you remove the outer shell of the black, you have the white, which is sort of a more pure dry heat, almost like what the Chinese use. So it sort of gives you a spicy, robust element.
This sounds like a politician who was asked, are you going to vote for the treaty or not? Then you digress.
No, but you know what? This also brings us back to the conversation about what salt to use, what pepper to use. So if you have something like a red meat, then you want to reach for the black pepper.
Here's what I don't get.
Yeah.
Why is pepper a ubiquitous thing that so many recipes? I understand salt. That's,
you know,
totally different.
I actually don't know.
I think you
history.
Should treat pepper like cumin, like turmeric.
You mean it shouldn't
like
be so knee-jerk?
Well, in a recipe where it's appropriate, you should use pepper and use more of it rather than just a couple of things, you know, twists. So it should be present and important, not this kind of
knee-jerk
below
thing.
the knee-jerk below the radar.
Salt and pepper, salt and pepper, salt and pepper.
Yeah, I don't.
You know what? I agree with you.
And you know why?
Yeah.
I think the reason is in Northern Europe, they didn't have many spices.
So this is what they could
I mean, the Ottomans
for.
Had 100. They had a few, and pepper was one of the things they had. It was probably the strongest thing they had, so they used it. But I think this is...
And maybe that was partially to hide the bad meat.
I think salt and pepper need to get a divorce. They have to go their own way and use pepper when appropriate, but salt all the time, pepper occasionally.
Chris Kimball, I agree with you.
Holy moly.
What a revelation. Well, I was just going to say, if you are going to use them, so white pepper, you know, is, as I said, a little drier heat. The Chinese use it a lot, white pepper.
But they don't use it in everything.
No, you're absolutely right.
I think pepper should be treated like any other spice.
I agree. Did we remotely answer your question there?
Well, it's just that you can taste something and you can taste the salt.
Right.
You know if you've undersalted, oversalted. But when do you know you over or under peppered?
Well, I think what we're saying here is you should treat it like any other spice and not say there is any gold standard for the right
like
amount of pepper.
Like steak au poivre.
Yeah, then you want to taste the pepper. But other than that, it should be like you wanted a hint of as Chris said, cumin.
Jackie, does that make sense to you? Do you agree?
Yeah, I think basically it's pepper doesn't really do anything unless it's a recipe that needs pepper.
Exactly.
But exactly.
I guess, like you say, use your own judgment, and we just do it because the recipe says salt and pepper.
We should just say salt and paprika.
Right.
Good.
I think it's because it goes together.
Okay.
I got that off my chest. I feel so much better.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
You're listening to Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. After the break, we take a trip to Chiang Mai in northern Thailand, where I met up with Chef Andy Ricker for a cooking lesson. Andy, by the way, is the owner of the Pok Pok restaurants here in the States and also an expert in the cuisines of northern Thailand.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You know, I like classic clothing that never goes out of style, and that's why I suggest you check out Quince, an online clothing store that focuses on timeless essentials at great prices. I recently bought a Mongolian cashmere sweater for under $100. It's a great sweater and a great deal. Now that warm weather is upon us, Quince has all the seasonal must-haves, like 100% European linen shirts from $30, performance polos, and versatile flow-knit activewear. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands by partnering directly with top factories. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. Upgrade your wardrobe. Go to quince.com/milkstreet for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/milkstreet. to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/milkstreet. You know, wonderful pistachios have become my go-to snack. Now, I could list all the health benefits. They're a good source of protein, fiber, and unsaturated fats. But for me, flavor comes first, and that's why it's pistachios, not peanuts, in our household. Wonderful pistachios come in a variety of flavors and sizes, including sea salt and vinegar, chili roasted, and smoked barbecue. Check out WonderfulPistachios.com to learn more. That's WonderfulPistachios.com.
This is Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Right now, it's time to talk to Andy Ricker. Andy is an American chef. He's owner of 6 Pok Pok restaurants in this country, also an expert in the cuisine of northern Thailand. I interviewed Andy in the late afternoon on the first floor of his teak house on the outskirts of Chiang Mai in Thailand. I started by asking Andy about the house and how Thai architecture is quite different than what we have here in the United States.
This cool house, so why don't you describe the construction method for a house like this?
Sure. So this is a typical Thai-style house. It's built on columns, raised up, at least the front part of the house. This is built out of teak. It's a salvaged wood from an old rice barn. The way that it's built is so that you do a lot of your living outside here. Down below the house, you get shelter, and it's cool and dry.
And it's all open.
And it's open all the way around. So this is typically where people would hang out during the day, have their social life, friends come over and talk. The upstairs is really for sleeping, more or less. And most of life happens outside. Cooking happens outside, usually a small kitchen either, kind of to the side of the house, in back of the house. Or in this case, we've built one kind of underneath the house to the side.
So this, you said this is in a very large valley, surrounded not entirely, but on three sides by mountains, I guess.
Yeah.
And Burma is 150 miles from here. Across
the mountain? Something like that. Not that far away, really. If you head due west from here, you get to Burma pretty quick.
So tell me about the House of Spirits. We were just talking about that at lunch. What's the House of Spirits?
So there's a spirit house on most properties. Almost every house in Thailand or business has a spirit house, and it's kind of set off to the side of the house, and it is a place where the people who live on the property invite the spirits from the land to go and stay, and so the humans can stay in their own house.
So does that mean that the house is taking up land where the spirits lived, and once you built the house, you need to give the spirits a place to go to? Is that what
that's it? That's more or less it. You're coming onto their land, and you want to first ask their permission to do so, and then provide them with a place to stay while we've taken up their space and using their land for our own purposes.
So how do you greet people here? I mean, physically, how do you do it? What do you say? What's the process of saying hello?
Well, typically Thai people greet each other by waing, basically placing your hands together, palms together, fingers up, kind of in a praying position, more or less. And it's a sign of respect. And depending on how high or low you wai, it depends on how important the person is in front of you. But Thai people, if they greet each other and say, Sawadee Kap, hello, Sabaidi Mai Kap, how are you doing? Ginkaliang Kap, which means, have you eaten rice yet? Or have you eaten yet? Which is not typically a literal, they're not literally looking for an answer. But it gives the person to say, oh, Ginlao Kap Kun Kap, I've eaten already. Or Yang Mai Gin, that might lead to an invitation to go and have something to eat.
So we were talking about Thai food, and one of the things you said, if someone said, how was the chicken? They might reply, it had a wonderful aroma, or it smelled good.
Yes.
So aroma is more important than anything else in cooking, or it's very important?
It's very important. In a lot of cases, it's more important depending on the dish. So, and it's counterintuitive to Westerners often. So when you say shrimp paste, we look at shrimp paste and we might take a smell of it and think, wow, what a pungent, strong odor. But a Thai person might say, oh, hao mak, it smells really good. So it's like with shrimp paste, you might say that it smells nice. You might necessarily take a taste and go, oh, aroi mak, or tastes great. The importance of smell and aroma in cooking here can't really be understated. I know cooks who cook by the sense of smell alone. They can smell whether it's salty enough or not. They think of things in terms of aroma that we wouldn't. So for instance, black pepper. They would say, oh, hom prik thai. So it smells like pepper, smells really good like pepper.
So there's no such thing as Thai cooking because there are different regions that are very different. We're in the north. So what are the regions and what are the basic differences?
So there's four basic regions of Thailand. There's the south of Thailand, which is peninsular Thailand that connects with Malaysia. The staple rice there is jasmine rice. Then you get to central Thailand, which is where the seat of power and culture is in Bangkok and the surrounding areas in the Chao Phraya River Delta. That's central Thai. That's where the Thai language a lot of the food that we eat in the West comes from this region. And then there's northeastern Thailand, or Isan, which goes along the Laos border, and also a little bit of Cambodia. And that's influenced by Laos, the people there, primarily ethnically Lao, some Khmer, and the staple rice there is sticky rice. And then the fourth major region is northern Thailand, which is where we are right now. Chiang Mai is the center of it, mountainous jungle region, and the people here speak northern Thai language, and their staple is sticky rice.
We've talked before about the different components of a dish in Thai cooking. Sweet, sour, bitter, salty. What's the philosophy when you think about putting together or cooking Thai food, no matter what region?
Well, I would say that Asian food, unlike Western food, which kind of builds flavor over time to come up with sort of a monolithic, single, kind of like strong, rich flavor. Thai food and Southeast Asian food in general tends to be this kind of like battle of different bright, salty, sweet, sour, hot, bitter, all working together in various different roles in particular dishes. But they don't meld to become one thing. Like often dishes here, you can taste everything that's going on all at once in a bite.
There are some combinations that are used all the time. Hot chilies with garlic that are mashed up. Cilantro with garlic. What are some of those pairings that are used as key flavorings in dishes?
Right, so there's also, often up north here especially, you see a combination of coriander, cilantro, green onion and sawtooth, or what we call pak chi falang, or foreigner's cilantro, which is kind of a sawtooth dandelion-shaped leaf, which is stronger version of cilantro, perhaps. Those chopped up and spread on top of things is really common. The use of garlic and garlic oil, combination of pork and prawns, which is very Chinese. You see that a lot in Thai cooking. Thai salads often have ground pork and prawns mixed into the same thing. Yeah, there's a lot of combinations. Fish sauce, lime juice, palm sugar. Those three things together form the basis of the dressing for almost any kind of Thai-style salad.
Steaming. We went to a market yesterday where the gentleman was selling steamed chicken with a chili paste. Steaming's done a lot here, and it's almost not done at all in the States.
Yeah, and that's one of the, it's a mystery to me because it's such a versatile, easy way of cooking things. They do everything from steaming rice, they steam meats, steam vegetables. A lot of the desserts that you have here in Thai, the sweets, are steamed. Steamed fish is huge here. People love plan nung, Bla's fish. Nung means steam. Plan nung manao. A classic Thai dish is a whole fish, typically like a striped bass, that's been scored down the side. And you make a mixture of cilantro root, garlic, green chilies, lime, maybe some fish sauce, a little bit of sugar. And you pour that on top of the fish, put it into the steamer, let it steam for 15 minutes or so until the fish is completely done. And the steam kind of drips down onto the plate that the fish is on and combines with the fish sauce, lime juice, coriander root, a little bit of sugar, maybe some white pepper, and makes a sauce that the fish is now sitting in. And it's delicious.
Eggs, you often cook them in very hot oil in a wok.
Mm-hmm.
So what are a couple of those?
So there's kai dao, which is, kai means egg, dao means star. So the Thai people look at this egg frying in a wok and they think it looks like a star. And I love this way of frying an egg because you get this nice crispy brown part of the egg white, and then the yolk stays nice and molten. And then the other thing that we did was kai jio, which is basically more or less a deep fried omelet. You pour the egg slowly into very hot oil until it puffs up. But there's a lot of other ways to do eggs, too, that you can steam them, as we saw at Rangaprao the other day, to make a really beautiful, simple custard. You can just pour hot water on an egg and let it sit for 5 or 10 minutes and crack it, and it's poached / coddled in the shell.
So yesterday we were at a chicken place, and the two things that were interesting was they used the coals, the cold ash from the day before, on top of the live coals, so there were no flare-ups, and I guess it moderated the heat. I mean, I've never seen that before. That was really interesting.
Right. So, over the years, I've really spent a lot of time watching the way people grill here and the way they use charcoal. And we use charcoal at the restaurant a lot. It's kind of really important to our menu to have cooking on charcoal. And what I've noticed here, and if you look at other cultures as well, people who are really into grilling tend to build a fire and then maintain the fire in whatever way they do. And then they, by changing the height of the grill off the fire, that's how they determine how fast or slow something cooks. So they make this big bed of sort of radiant heat from the charcoal, and then they just kind of raise or lower the grill a little bit. Or, as you saw with the chicken guy, he literally uses the chickens that are clamped with bamboo sticks to raise or lower the chicken so that he can cook the breast longer or the legs longer or the side of the chicken longer. But it's all about varying the height of the thing you're cooking relative to the charcoal rather than trying to regulate the heat of the fire itself.
So give me a couple examples of things that have happened to you or experiences in Thailand that really would never happen back in the States.
Yeah, so going into a market, right? This is something that's really uniquely Thai. You go into a country like we did this morning. We went to the local market. It's just a little tiny wet market that serves the small community around here.
And you said it opens at 4:30 or something?
Yeah, it opens at 4:30 in the morning. By 7:30, it's done. 8 o'clock, you wouldn't even know that it had happened. You know, we went there to buy a few things, some vegetables, a little bit of pork, a little bit of chicken, that kind of thing. And, you know, as soon as we walk in, all heads perk up, and people are kind of talking to each other across the aisle. They're talking to you. Where do you live? Where did you come from? I speak Thai, and then people start laughing, and then there's like this kind of like everybody's talking. It's a very friendly, open place, and especially in northern Thailand, people are generous with their time and their knowledge, and that's not really something you see as much in the United States. We tend to stay in our own houses. We go to the coffee shop. We get in front of our computers and kind of stay with our friends. And you go to the market here, and everybody's wide open, yelling at each other across the market. And, you know, it's a very open, fun place.
The king died not too long ago.
Yeah.
And I really been struck by the fact that he was so beloved among the people, which is not something in America you're used to at all.
Right.
It's a very, very different relationship. So could you just talk about that? I mean, people, you know, are in mourning still a long time after.
Right.
And for us, it's something that's quite different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, what you have to remember is that most of the people who are living today in Thailand have only known one king their whole life. He reigned for 70 plus years, and he was beloved by the people. He did a lot of really good work for this country. He was really dedicated to helping the less fortunate people, introducing agricultural systems to help people lift themselves up. So he did a lot of really great things. He was a great musician and a composer. So he contributed to the arts, and to the Thai people, he was almost godlike in a way. So when he passed away, even though people knew it was coming, it was still a huge shock. And the official mourning period was 30 days, but really, it's going to be a year of mourning. And then he'll be remembered forever. Like, he's going to go down in Thai history. People will keep that picture of the king on their wall.
So when you first came here 30 years ago, was there one moment when you knew you were going to be coming back a lot? Did something happen, or was it just gradual?
I think it was gradual, but I had like a couple of moments where, you know, when you travel by yourself and you can't speak a language and you're in this strange culture, you can feel pretty isolated and pretty left out of things. And if you're not a real outgoing kind of personality, it can be a little daunting and unwelcoming. So I had to take a bus from Koh Tao, southern Thailand, all the way to Bangkok because I lost a contact lens. And the one I needed wasn't in the nearest town. So I had to go to Bangkok on the local bus. And I had no money. I was a backpacker. I think the bus ride to Bangkok was like $4 or $5 at the time. It was like 150 baht all the way to Bangkok. And that's like a 14-hour bus ride. But it was the local bus. So you're in these bench seats with like three or four people across. And the folks who were on the bus were like construction workers, local folks. Nobody spoke English at all, including the driver. But there were a couple of fishermen sitting next to me who had a bottle of rice whiskey and a bottle of Lipo Witan, which is a energy drink. And they said, hey, you know, they kind of motioned for me to come over, gave me a few shots. And, you know, 20 minutes later, after six more shots, we were best buddies. And I couldn't say anything except for thank you, kap kun kap, kap kun kap, kap kun kap. And at some point, somebody like waved the bus driver down and said, you know, said something. And people kind of got up and started filing, like the guys I was with started filing off the bus. And I was like, oh, I gotta go to the bathroom. So I like ran off the bus with them, took a leak on next to the bus, and the bus erupted in laughter. we all like stumbled drunk back onto the bus, and people were laughing, and it was just, you know, it was a really great moment. Like, I was an outsider, they didn't know me, I didn't know them, but we were having a fun moment. And, you know, if you can have that kind of experience in a situation where you don't know the language, you don't know the people, you know, that's something that makes you feel welcome.
That was Andy Ricker. I visited Andy at his house near Chiang Mai in northern Thailand. Thai cooking is not subtle. Unlike French cooking, one starts with simple ingredients, rice, chicken, greens, or perhaps pork, and then one employs a wide array of strong flavorings to make the dish: chilies, galangal, lime leaves, shallot, garlic, shrimp paste, etc. Now, this redefines fast food, since flavor is not dependent on time. You actually start with big flavors. You don't need time and heat to develop them. That's why one travels. Other people halfway across the world often know something that you don't. I just wish that I had visited Thailand sooner. You're listening to Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Right now it's time to talk to New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik, who discusses how we can endure dark times by cooking, eating, and sharing food. Adam, how are you?
I'm all right. Christopher, how are you?
That doesn't sound promising. All right.
These are, in many respects, kind of gloomy or easily shaken days. And in fact, that's exactly what I wanted to talk to you about, Christopher, and that is the relationship of cooking and catastrophe, how we put those two things together. Now, of course, we have food catastrophes locally in the kitchen all the time, right? The souffle that doesn't rise, the béarnaise sauce that won't quite knit, all of those things. But I had in mind a different kind of catastrophe. I got to thinking about how it is and why it is that eating is so closely related to mourning, why eating is so closely related to sorrow. You know, it's an interesting thing. I'm sure you've thought about this, Chris, that in every culture that I'm aware of, we use food, it's true, and we celebrate food for moments when life seems positive. We have wedding feasts, and we have birthday feasts, and we have christening feasts, and so on. But we also have an intimate relationship with food when we are in despair, when we are desperate. It's fascinating, isn't it, that every culture has a funeral meal. The first thing we do when the worst thing happens, when someone close to us dies, is gather people around us and start eating.
I would assume that's because one wants to immediately go to something normal and social, right?
I think that's right, and that's exactly what I've been thinking about. I've been through, you know, several, when I say catastrophes, of course, I don't mean the apocalyptic ones that blow up the world, but keen disappointments, shocking events, public difficulties of all kinds. And what always is astonishing to me is how quickly people coalesce to eat. Now, one theory of why people come together to eat at moments of high stress or intense mourning is, of course, that there's comfort in it. You know, we've talked in the past about comfort food and the ins and outs of comfort food and what that means. And that's one theory of it. You know, Elizabeth Luard, in her wonderful book, Sacred Food, talks about all of the ways that people celebrate or take in funerals around the world. And she points out that there's a kind of eerie similarity among the ways people do it. The things from culture to culture that seem most closely associated with meals of mourning and remembrance are, first of all, roasted meats, and secondly, things that are shaped like heavenly objects, like the sun and stars. Think of how many round breads we associate again and again with wakes and kaddishes. It seems to be a deep human association between the look of the heavens and the things that you eat in times of mourning. So that's one way of thinking about mourning food. It's one way of thinking about what we eat when we're sad, is that we eat a certain number of things that we find comforting. But I think that it's even more important that not so much the special ritual nature of the foods we choose to eat, it's exactly the sameness of things that we want to assert. More than any other part of our life, eating with our friends and with our family enforces the chronic nature of our human lives, that the earth turns round, the sun comes up, and we will always be hungry again. And so every time that we come together for a wake or a kaddish or an improvised mourning after a political event, whatever it might be, we are asserting not so much the specialness of the comfort that we seek, we're asserting the absolute normality of the time that we're in.
So instead of saying life goes on, the table goes on.
Yes, exactly, Chris. And that those two things are so closely allied that they often mean exactly the same thing. You know, I think about my first memory of eating in a time of pain goes all the way back to the assassination of John Kennedy, which took place when I was about 7 years old. I don't know, are you old enough to remember it clearly?
I remember exactly. I heard it right after lunch hour. I was in elementary school, and I was 13 at the time, I think. Yeah, the school was called together, and the head of the school talked to us.
I remember, too. I was a little bit younger, but like all of us, it was the first public event that stands out for me. And, of course, as you remember, one of the things that made it so strange as a time of national mourning is that it immediately preceded Thanksgiving. And I remember it was one of my keenest memories of the nature of loss and the meaning of loss that we both had to celebrate Thanksgiving, my family did, and at the same time, we couldn't celebrate Thanksgiving. And I remember being struck by the sense that my mother and my grandmother preparing the Thanksgiving feast meant that they were tied to a clock that would turn inevitably, that there was no option of canceling the Thanksgiving feast, that it automatically became a kind of feast for mourning for the dead president by the very fact of its compulsory nature. If that makes any sense to you, Christopher, that we were bound to have the Thanksgiving feast, and the feast, in a sense, would find its own level by the feelings that we brought to it. And I've been struck by that again and again in my own experience of public mourning. I remember being so struck on the day of 9/11 when I was downtown in Lower Manhattan right after the plane struck. And I walked all the way home to our house on 88th Street. And I stopped in restaurants and supermarkets along the way just with my notebook open. And what was astounding was the number of people who were compiling what I called at the time sort of apocalyptic grocery baskets, presumably because they were trying to be practically minded and wondering if food deliveries would be cut off, a kind of slightly absurd thought given the circumstances of New York provisioning. But nonetheless, they were. But at some other deeper level, there was an immediate kind of appetite in the deepest possible sense to fill up your larder when you are frightened, to go back to your stove when you are distressed, to share food with your friends when you are miserable. And it seems to me that that connection, as I said before, is less a connection to comfort than it is a connection to the relentlessness of time, to repositioning ourselves in the calendar in a way that has an inexorability about it. Less about comfort and more about the necessity of the human calendar to assert itself.
Well, maybe the kitchen is both the safest room in the house and also the most timeless, right?
That's eloquently said, Chris. It is the safest room in the house, and it is the timeless one, and it's the place where we go when we're in difficulty with our kids, and it's a way of not just, you know, in the theater, the primary rule is show, don't tell, right? It's the actions characters take on stage that really assert their moral character, and I think that's true in life, too. It's by going into the kitchen and cooking for our children when they feel anxious or depressed, we are actually showing them, not merely telling them, that life can continue.
That was Adam Gopnik, a regular contributor to The New Yorker. This is Mill Street Radio. I'm your host, Christopher Kimball. After the break, Dan Pashman tells us his New Year's resolution. It has something to do with pajamas, late nights, and something whipped. You know, I grew up with Vermont farmers who made do with tools they had on hand. A hammer, pliers, and baling twine, of course, for most jobs. When I became a cook, however, I found that having just the right knife or maybe the perfect carbon steel skillet made all the difference. And the right tool also added pleasure to my cooking. I truly enjoyed my time prepping as well as cooking food. And that also goes for a car. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. And that includes available dynamic sky panorama glass roof, available front row massaging seats, available 33-inch all-terrain tires, and available multi-terrain select. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX, luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This is Mill Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Right now it's time to take some calls with Sarah Moulton. Sarah, are you ready to go?
I am ready.
Welcome to Mill Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Andrea Shasted from Louisville, Kentucky. And I have a question about grilling shrimp, the proper way, and how long to cook it on a barbecue.
That's hard because shrimp cook very fast. And it's also the barbecue. Is this gas or charcoal?
Charcoal.
Okay. You never have exactly the right same temperature twice in a row. So I would say in the shell is a must.
And the larger the better.
Get the biggest, the 16-20s.
Jumbo guys, yeah.
They're 16 to 20 per pound or jumbo, and cook them in the shell because without the shell, you'll just torch the outside. A minute aside tops. Okay. They're very quick.
I think a minute aside would be okay, and then get them off
and let them
sit for a second. Mm.
We just did a recipe for Chipotle shrimp. These were shelled. We put raw shrimp in a hot sauce off the heat and let them cook in the
and
sauce. And that's how fast
they
cook.
You know what it is? They don't have any connective tissue and they don't have any fat running through them. So there's sort of no protection. It's just like it goes right to the protein and it just cooks so quickly it can get tough.
Mm.
I feel like we told you terrible news. You sound sad.
I am because I always serve my shrimp with the shell off so that people don't have to then pick it up and peel it off and it's a big mess. It's just so much easier if they could eat.
Well, then, here's what I would do. Go ahead and shell them, and then, but large, and toss them with oil.
Right.
Season them, and then just get it on a really hot fire really quickly. And here's what I always do when I'm cooking something for the first time, and I don't sort of know how it's going to go. This is true for baking something, too. I do a test pilot. Do a Lone Ranger. And give him or her 30 seconds on each side and then take it off and give it another 30 seconds or so to cool and then cut into it and see if it's cooked all the way through and sort of.
But I would also use a fish or vegetable basket.
Yeah.
Because turning 15 or 20 shrimp, you'll never get it right. So do you use a basket of some kind when you grill?
No, I put them on a skewer.
They twist when you lift them up, so double skewers.
And what kind of oil?
Whatever you like.
Not olive, no. Okay. I would use canola.
Not olive oil.
It has a low
safflower.
Smoke point.
Yeah. Something cheap and sturdy.
Well, I will experiment.
Okay.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Thanks for calling. Welcome to Milk Street. Who's calling?
Hi, this is Laura Jane Wright.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm good. How can we help you?
Well, I got your first edition of Milk Street Magazine, and I have looked at this chocolate prune and rum cake, and I have a question about the salt.
Okay.
So you use salted butter, which is interesting, and then you have kosher salt, and I was wondering about the coarseness of the salt. Fine salt, kosher salt, or coarse ground kosher salt?
This is Sarah and I are going to go at it.
Yeah, we are.
So I think, even though I'm the only person in the world who believes this, that a coarse kosher salt in baking's fine. I've never had a problem with the salt not dispersing properly. And now Sarah's going to tell you, I can tell that I'm absolutely wrong.
What you can't see is the look on my face.
Yeah, it's like horror.
Yeah, I really firmly believe. Now, of course, I'd like to do a comparison that fine salt dissolves much better because it's just smaller pieces than kosher salt. So that's the one time I use fine salt. I really don't have a good grinder. I know they're out there. For sea salt, I'd probably use sea salt. But if I don't, I just use table salt.
Right. So. Okay, can I just ask, look, if you're going to whip egg whites or melt butter or bake a batter, you put in a half a teaspoon of kosher salt.
It doesn't dissolve
the same going way. To...
Like when you make a vinaigrette, you always add the salt to the vinegar so that it dissolves.
I'm experienced in marriage, and I know there are times when you just say nothing.
All right, well, that is my sincere opinion, and most pastry chefs, I think, would agree. But I'd like to do a taste test, so...
One thing I should say about kosher salt, coarse kosher salt,
You can pick it up with your fingers. I actually don't use table salt ever anymore. I like kosher salt.
You like to be able to measure it.
Yeah, and you know, kosher salt is just easy to work with. But I admit there are a number of people in the world who agree with Sarah.
Well, when Julia and Jacques had their cooking show, they couldn't agree on anything. And it was very funny because at that point, each of them had been cooking for like 60 years. And if between the two of them with 120 years experience, they couldn't agree on anything, it makes you wonder, is there any definitive answer to anything? But they couldn't even agree on salt and pepper. They had his and hers.
Who used what?
She had black pepper for most things, white pepper for white things,
right. Kosher
salt for meat, and fine salt for baking. He had kosher salt and black pepper.
Good. Yes.
Go Jacques.
Go Jacques.
That's what you're saying.
Yes, go
anyway,
Jacques.
Anyway, so that's just one girl's opinion, but that is what I think.
Okay. Well, we agreed to...
Disagree.
Kind of disagree.
Yes. Okay.
So there you go.
All right. Well, Laura, thank you for calling.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Take care. This is Mill Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. If you'd like your cooking questions answered, please give us a ring. The number is 1-855-4-BOWTIE. One more time, 1-855-4-BOWTIE. You can also email us at questions@milkstreetradio.com. You can also find our shows on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn, or at our own website, which is milkstreetradio.com. Right now it's time for this week's Milk Street Basic. This week's Milk Street Basic is all about how to use vegetable juice instead of water in cooking. You know, lots of French chefs like Jean-Georges Vongerichten are actually well known for their Michelin stars, but also they like to use vegetable juice instead of water as a base for cooking rice and grains. Now, here at Milk Street, we love carrot juice. It's available at most supermarkets. And we use it instead of water for rice, quinoa, or even bulgur. That's this week's Milk Street Basic. This is Milk Street Radio. I'm Christopher Kimball. Dan Pashman is the voice behind the Sporkful podcast, and he's also a regular Milk Street contributor. Dan, how are you?
I'm doing well, Chris. Thanks.
I'm not even going to ask what's on your mind this week because I just have no idea.
Well, it's probably something that's been on your mind recently, and it's the new year. It's time for New Year's resolutions, Chris. And and on the Sporkful podcast, we like to do resolutions that are different from a lot of typical resolutions. My listeners and I each pick a food that we resolve to eat more of in the new year.
Oh,
I don't know. Do you have one? Can you think of a food that you resolve to eat more of this coming year?
Yeah, okay. I have one that's really weird.
Good, let's hear it.
I was in Thailand doing a thing, and I fell in love with tamarind. In fact, it makes the world's best barbecue sauce, tamarind.
Really?
Paste. Yeah, I didn't care about the chicken, but the sauce was great. So I'm going for tamarind. It makes a great drink, too. So that's my annoying world traveler food.
I think there's a working man's tamarind to be found. I mean, have you had that Mexican Jarritos soda that's tamarind flavored?
No. All right. Well, so there you go. Thank you.
Right.
So what is your resolution for the new year?
Well, my New Year's food resolution this year, Chris, and I assume you'll add a drum roll in here later on. My New Year's food resolution is that in 2017, I resolved to eat more homemade whipped cream. And I want to say, I picked this as my resolution before news broke of this nationwide shortage of canned whipped cream. Have you heard about this?
No, I'm very upset. What has caused that?
There was a huge explosion of a nitrous oxide tank at a gas plant back over the summer, and it halted nitrous oxide production. And it has resulted in a shortage of canned whipped cream that should be rectified soon, but it's a great opportunity to resolve to eat more homemade whipped cream, which I made so much of at Thanksgiving, and I had it left over. So I was eating it out of my fridge for a couple of days. And I got to tell you, Chris, whipped cream's great on pie and ice cream and fruit and all the things that we know about. But my most delicious bites of homemade whipped cream after Thanksgiving came when it was left over in my fridge. And I would, after the kids were in bed, go down into the kitchen by yourself in your pajamas and stand in the middle of the kitchen eating the leftover whipped cream directly out of the container.
How much did you eat?
I mean, I went through one large container of heavy cream. Over the course of two whippings, I whipped one batch and then a few days later whipped another batch.
And you think this is something you'd want to continue well into the new year?
Yeah, I'm resolving to.
It's not a one-off.
Yeah. No, no.
So I get the whipped cream, but my concept would be eat whipped cream. It's an opportunity to eat things that go with whipped cream, right?
Okay, go on.
Well, I mean, there's pecan pie, there's apple pie, there are brownies, there are custards, trifle. I mean, it's an opportunity to consume lots of desserts that are desperately in need of whipped cream, which I do understand that, chocolate especially.
One of the reasons why I prefer to make a New Year's resolution about what I'm going to eat more of, as opposed to what I'm going to eat less of, or cutting back, or hitting the gym, or whatever, is that there's been some new data I've been looking at that shows that a lot of these resolutions people make about hitting the gym and cutting back on unhealthy foods are pretty short-lived. In fact, data from the location app Foursquare says that right after the new year, visits to gyms shoot up and visits to fast food restaurants go down. But very soon, those trends start to reverse. And on average, on the first Thursday of February, that's when the two lines cross, and the visits to fast food restaurants go up to the point that they meet the plummeting visits to gyms. And then this is what I love. The most interesting thing is that the single biggest day of the year for fast food comes just the very next week. The second Friday of February is the biggest day for fast food for the whole year. And Foursquare has dubbed that day the fatty solstice.
Well, it makes sense because you've been holding back for 5 weeks, right? And so
right.
It's a return to normalcy.
Right. So what would your fatty solstice food be, Chris?
I have something similar. Marshmallows. I love marshmallows.
Mm.
And I do actually sometimes late at night go in and eat marshmallows.
Yeah, okay. Have you ever tried whipped cream on your marshmallows?
I could, yeah. Probably not. So I'm going to eat more tamarind. You're going to eat more whipped cream.
Homemade whipped cream, yes.
Since you're starting out with fatty, maybe your curve will go the opposite way.
That's right. Maybe by the end of the year, I'll be drinking tamarind soda with you.
And working out at the gym.
Right.
Dan Pashman, thank you for your New Year's resolution for 2017. Thank you.
Thanks, Chris. Happy New Year.
That was Dan Pashman from the Sparkful Podcast. On today's show, I visited Andy Ricker in northern Thailand, and I did have a final thought. You know, when I arrived at Chiang Mai Airport, I was met by Nok. She's the charming local fixer who greeted me in the Y fashion. Hands are chin high in a prayer-like gesture. And at the time, I really didn't know what to do. 3 days later, as we were saying our goodbyes, I bowed to Nok in my best imitation of Y. Now, I had learned something, just a gesture, but enough to remind me that I was bringing back something precious from Thailand, something old and something new. Thanks for listening to Mill Street Radio. You can listen to our weekly shows on iTunes, Stitcher, and TuneIn, and also on our very own website, that's milkstreetradio.com, where you can also download each week's recipe.
Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is produced by Milk Street in association with WGBH. Executive producers Melissa Baldino and Stephanie Stender. Producer Amy Padula. Production assistant Carly Helmetog. Senior audio engineer Douglas Sugars. Senior audio editor Melissa Allison with help from Vicky Merrick and Sydney Lewis. Audio mixing by Jay Allison at Atlantic Public Media. Production help Debbie Paddock. Theme music by Tubob Crew. Additional music by George Brandel Egloff. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio is distributed by PRX.